This week on Making Contact.
Throughout my schooling years until probably, say, middle school, I didn't have much of a good experience with African-American people.
Mautan Akron is a Nigerian immigrant growing up in Oakland, California.
I would be asked, like, on a regular basis where my tail was, or did I swim here?
And it wasn't really the other kids of color, you know, like the Asian kids or the Latino kids. It was mostly just African-American kids, and I'm like, what's going on here? I mean, aren't we the same skin tone? Aren't we kind of from the same place?
On this edition, we explore the tensions between African immigrants and Black Americans through the eyes of one local high school student. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. African immigrants are the fastest growing segment of the Black population in the U.S. But the cultural boundaries between Black Americans and African immigrants are often hard to break down. In a special collaboration between National Radio Project and the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, student producer Amy Jeffries introduces us to Mautan Akron.
Okay, my name is Mautan Kojo-Wolabi Akron. I'm currently a senior at Oakland Technical High School now, and looking forward to graduation.
Mautan! Oh, what's up, man?
Mautan Akron is among the more than 500,000 African immigrants who've arrived in the U.S. since 1990. That's more than were brought over from the continent during the slave trade.
I was born in Nigeria. Moved here in 1997 at the age of 6. And my father is King of Badagry. And my title is, of course, Prince.
In the San Francisco Bay Area, where Prince Mautan lives, about 1 in 10 Blacks identify themselves as sub-Saharan African. At Oakland Tech, a predominantly Black high school in a predominantly Black city, Mautan is among a noticeable handful of African students.
This class is out of control. Somebody stop this class.
It's sixth period, and Mautan is hunched over his algebra book. He's taking this class for the second time, and he's got to pass it to graduate. The underclassmen in the room couldn't care less. Instead of calculating the value of X, they trade gossip and make fun of the teacher's heavy Middle Eastern accent. When I step out of the room, Mautan switches on my recorder so he can show me what he has to tune out in order to get his work done.
African man, don't touch him.
He turned it on. He's recording everything he's saying.
Did you hear that? Mautan's classmate called him Africa man, and it wasn't a compliment. Mautan says in high school, much of the teasing has subsided. But when he first started going to school here, it was really tough.
I would be asked, like, on a regular basis where my tail was, or did I swim here? Just, like, really painful jokes. Like, I'm so dark that if it was at night, nobody would be able to see me. It, like, really hurt. Like, that was, like, really, like, the end of the world.
And it wasn't really the other kids of color, you know, like the Asian kids or the Latino kids. It was mostly just African-American kids. And I'm like, what's going on here? I mean, aren't we the same skin tone? Aren't we kind of from the same place? It seemed kind of awkward because we pretty much look alike, you know, except for the fact that I'm from another country and you were born here. Throughout my schooling years until probably, say, middle school, I didn't have much of a good experience with African-American people.
African immigrants like Mautan often complain of feeling alienated from the Black community. Gerald Lenoir, an advocate for solidarity between African immigrants and Black Americans, says Black Americans feel rejected too.
If I'm in a group of African Americans, many times I've heard people remark about how uppity Africans are and how they rather relate to white people than to Black people. That's seen as a rejection by African Americans oftentimes.
Indeed, it was white people that Mautan was looking forward to hanging out with when he came to the U.S. That's because back in Nigeria, which was colonized by the British, white people are still revered for having wealth and power in the world.
when Caucasian people would come to Nigeria, they would be like really prominent businessmen. When you like see these people, you perceive them to be on top of the world.
Of course, on top of the world is exactly where Malton wants to end up.
When I grow up, essentially when I turn 18, which is like next year, essentially I want to do a lot of things. I'm shooting to go to school for graphic design and marketing. I really see myself as an entrepreneur, because I can't see myself working a desk job for like 31 years, you know.
Malton's dreams of going to college and getting a good job are not unusual, really. Many of Malton's Black American classmates have plans for college and professional careers, too.
I want to go into a four-year college and major in either business or music and play football.
I'm taking my diploma to the hood. Nah, I'm just joking. I'm going to go to a two-year college and see about transferring if I like it.
I'm going to make it in 2 years. I don't know what college. It's going to be a good one.
But if Malton is looking for a role model, he's more likely, nearly twice as likely, to find an African immigrant than a Black American with a college degree. And African immigrants tend to have better paying jobs, too. On average, they make 10% more a year, about $1,700 more than their Black American counterparts.
I am Ugo Nwokeji. I'm a professor in the Department of African American Studies, University of California at Berkeley. And I'm a historian by training and a Nigerian. African Americans not being well represented in the social class that most Africans aspire to be in. You know, and Africans, you know, naturally would like to understand why this is the case. But instead of doing an analysis, they already have an explanation out there that they just imbibe.
Geraldine Moore says African immigrants often have a negative view of Black Americans before they even arrive in the U.S.
Black immigrants come to this country with stereotypes of African Americans. They're lazy, they don't want to work, they've been here 400 years and they can't make it in society. I come and I can make it, so why can't they? Those types of attitudes.
One thing that I see that I really have come to dislike, but I mean, maybe it's just me, and I don't really blame African American people for it, you know, but there is no way that you should ever be satisfied, you know, living off of Social Security money. And especially, you know, living in the country that you do live in. I mean, there are people that would, like, die to be in your position. You are an American citizen, you know. You can make things happen for yourself. You know, you cannot just sit on your butt all day in some broke-down shack and wait for a check to come in. You know, I don't limit it to just African Americans, but I don't really see a lot of Asian people just sitting in the house waiting for $600 a month.
Malton wants to distinguish himself from his Black American peers. He'll speak the popular slang with his classmates only because he thinks he has to.
What's up?
Most of the time, if somebody's gonna say, I am going to do something, it's I'ma do this.
If you go to Oakland Tech and you speak like you're from like Bel Air, you're not really gonna just slide through. And if you come in and you speak Queen's English, you know, with people that don't really understand Queen's English, you know, you're gonna be kind of out of the loop.
Hey, did you guys lose the game yesterday too?
Yeah, they did.
Before I really started hanging out with, you know, talking to people, like having conversations at school and just kicking it and hanging out with people, I spoke like proper English, straight. So, like, I've had to like catch up on slang a lot. And I still think I'm behind in slang right now.
But Malton is proud of his command of proper English.
Definitely young people, especially young people, you have to be able to speak proper English, because there is no way that you can make it in a professional setting, you know, speaking like you on the block. You know, it's just not going to work out. You can't go to your boss and be like, yo, what's up?
Malton tries to look professional, too. Almost every other Black boy in Malton's high school wears baggy jeans, down low to show off the ostentatious embroidery on their oversized back pockets. Malton has his own pair of stylish baggy jeans, but he wears them up to his waist. And often, instead of wearing jeans to school, he dresses up.
Today I wore a brown velvet jacket and a brown button-up shirt, tan Marc Ecko pants, and Steve Madden wingtips. I guess it's an issue of presentation, because, you know, if you see somebody that's dressed up like they work in City Hall, you most likely gonna pay more mind to what he or she has to say than what somebody that's dressed like a drug dealer, the person that's, you know, dressed with baggy jeans and is sagging.
My name is Queen Rhoda Abimbola Akran. That's my last born. Prince Mountain Akran.
Mountain's mother also wants to be sure that her son is presenting himself as a proper gentleman.
I watch Mountain closely to stay away from those languages and so many other things that I see that are wrong.
Many of the things she sees as wrong are the cornerstones of Black American culture and style.
When you sag your pant, you know when they sag their pant.
Some Black guy, you know, wearing his pants below his buttocks. Yeah, that right there. That's basically what sagging is.
That I'm warning him against. Why should he be sagging pant? I have never seen a white person sag their pant. A white, responsible white man. Well, you see his pant up to his navel with his suspender, holding it from dropping. So where on earth do they, you know, find the idea of sagging, putting your pant down? It's a very, very immoral act. Very immoral. So I don't let him. In Nigeria, we are colonized by the British. If you're a man, you put your tie, you dress like a gentleman. And America here, I see them. I see how they dress. I don't know what to call those people. They are putting themselves down by dressing that way, sagging your pant.
Now I don't look like every other kid that goes to my school. I don't look like any other kid that you see walking down the street. It's a good thing to stand out, I think, because if there was a robbery that was just committed and it's in a predominantly Black neighborhood where everybody wears baggy jeans, white tees, blue jeans, and a pair of Nikes, you know, the primary suspect is going to be somebody that's wearing that same clothing. It really does set a tone for a person to be stereotyped and looked at a certain way.
I'm still African. Even though the world is getting smaller and smaller and we borrowing cultures, still the essence of what it means to be African is still with us. That's how I say it, I mean. I'm still African, yes. In a bag of jeans and snicks, white tees, hats, do-rags, waves underneath. In fact, I think in English. Press straight to greet my elders, but it's good morning when I speak. Toothbrush, overture and sticks, still water over tissue paper. But I think it's hygienic, despite what I choose to believe. Christianity, Islam, paganism, traditionalism might not appease the gods, but I break down with Hamor to celebrate the festival. Pound of yam with a gusiani fork, again with my bare hands instead of using a fork.
Coming up next.
Definitely in this situation, we look the damn same, so it really shouldn't be that much of a stretch to look at a cat and be like, you African, I'm African American, we must have a similar history, and we will have a similar experience in this nation. Like, regardless, the cop is gonna pull us both over. The cop is gonna ask us the same question the same way.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to Black and African, produced by UC Berkeley journalism graduate student Amy Jeffries.
In Nigeria, Queen Akran lived the life of royalty. She and her family did not have much personal wealth, but their needs were well met by the community that her husband, the King of Badagry, still serves. But there's no cash being sent from Nigeria to support the queen here. And even if her family had money to send, those contributions would be nullified by the unfavorable exchange rate from naira to dollars. When she brought her son to the U.S. for medical reasons, Queen Akran had to give up her relatively pampered life.
Things are very tough here. I came from a wealthy environment. I have people that takes care of me. I don't work. I'm a leader of women, a mother of the whole city. That's the role I was playing. You compare that one to being a pauper, to be slugging it out, running around, running after the bus to get to wherever I want to go.
Here, Queen Akran is among the working poor. When she hasn't been called to work a shift as a nurse's aide, she keeps busy in her clothing shop in downtown Oakland, trying to make ends meet. The walls of the shop are covered with school uniforms and African-style gowns that she's created. The shelves are overwhelmed with beaded necklaces and head wraps. The floor is piled high with bolts of cloth ready to be cut and sewn. The Queen's shop sits in the middle of a block of black-owned businesses. There's a barbershop across the street and a bail bondsman next door. The police department identifies the neighborhood as one of Oakland's most troublesome beats, and the city is already ranked as one of the most dangerous in the country. Huh? Queen Akran greets the other shop owners when she passes them on the street, but she doesn't feel safe in this neighborhood. She barricades the door when she and Mautan are in the shop after dark, and she says she feels lucky her son has stayed out of trouble.
It will be in the house. If I go out, it will be in the house until I come back. He will never open his door to nobody. We have lived in a very dangerous and very deadly area before, where they are selling cocaine, where they are shooting themselves once in every week. And my son has never gone down there to join them, never.
He doesn't go with any gang. No student here in America that doesn't belong to one gang or the other. My son doesn't belong to any gang. Not at all. City of thugs, city of slugs, city where they find you buying little puddle of blood, city where they play quick, the bus shots in the open. I'm from hell,
man. Something head, walk from open. Despite the challenges of poverty and inner city distractions, Queen Akran wants her son to take advantage of the opportunities the U.S. offers, to take his education to the highest level and get a job in a lucrative field.
And I believe in one day, I am going back to Nigeria, show my son's hand to the people of Nigeria. He has the egg, the embryo has become a whole chicken. The egg has hatched into a whole chicken.
Mautan has other ideas. That's Mautan playing a solo during his lunch hour at school.
Maybe you should get some protective goggles.
His mother doesn't want to hear it, but Mautan's real passion isn't business. It's music.
I do want to produce music, and then I want to, as a career goal for myself, I'm a freelance drummer. I want to record an album and or go on tour with a major recording label artist.
Now we are fighting. You can't choose music. You can be a doctor. You can be a lawyer. You can be an engineer. What do you mean music? That is falling into my deaf ears because I want him to do something else first before music. I told my son, you better get away from music now and go into school. Leave the music now. Face the studies now. The requirements to go to the university. I want him to be able to come out in a flying color. He doesn't have to go to any other pre-college or preliminary thing. He will just go straight away into the university.
But Mautan has a C-minus average. He hasn't applied to any four-year colleges yet. And instead of focusing on his academics, Mautan often stays up late working on music on his computer. Those late nights are affecting his performance in the classroom, too. He falls asleep in class a lot, and sometimes he doesn't make it to his morning classes at all. Derek Smith is one of Mautan's teachers.
his attendance is not very good. And when he is there, he has issues staying awake. That's just not good. And more so than any other student, no one has the combination of like cutting and actually falling asleep in class. Mauton is very unique.
Midway through his senior year, Mauton was in danger of failing three of his classes. If he doesn't pass those classes, he won't get his diploma.
Yeah, no, it's a real possibility. I mean, if he's sleeping and not showing up, you know, there's an amazing ability that we have to screw ourselves over in the last two semesters of high school. I focus on my black males as far as their behavior, their body language, their participation in class. And so when he's falling asleep, like right in front of me, I'm like, dude, you just got to step it up. You can blame this system, but I'm telling you right now, this system is designed for you to fail. So we know that from jump. So step it up. That requires at the ground level, students studying where they don't want to study, coming to school where they don't want to come to school, and staying awake when they don't feel like it.
Smith knows what Mauton is up against from personal experience. Smith grew up in Oakland too, and he identifies with Mauton, not as a Nigerian or an African immigrant, but as a young black male.
I'm a black male myself, as you know, but you can't really tell on audio. Well, maybe you can, Ebonics and things. If you're a young black or young African male, you're gonna have some stuff stacked up against you. We're a low-income city, we're a high minority city in a country that targets minorities for poverty and other things. So when I say step it up, it's not step it up like this is all your fault. I'm saying step it up like it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. It is a fight against an oppressive structure. It is a resistance struggle.
Smith believes that common experience of oppression and discrimination should be used to bring solidarity among black people, regardless of nationality or heritage.
Definitely in this situation, we look the damn same, so it really shouldn't be that much of a stretch to look at a cat and be like, you African, I'm African American, we must have a similar history, and we will have a similar experience in this nation. Like, regardless, the cop is going to pull us both over. The cop is going to ask us the same question the same way. And if we have no real established beef, then perhaps we should be linked together and doing work together, because there's obviously things that I believe people that weren't raised here can bring to communities that have been raised here.
Mauton may try to distinguish himself from his black American peers by dressing up or speaking proper English, but he knows that he cannot totally escape the racial hierarchy that persists in this country.
People don't see me as a Nigerian person. They see me as a black person, you know.
There's a lot of things that you hear growing up as a black person. And I know any black person can relate to me when I say this. You know, you hear a lot of things. You hear a lot of people telling you what you can and what you can't do just because of your skin tone.
Mauton has come to appreciate the achievements of black Americans in their struggles for civil rights and the emancipation from slavery. And in Derek Smith's class, he's come to identify with some of that history as his own.
My favorite class in school is Triumph. And that class is instructed by Derek Smith.
Hi, Derek.
This is what we call trying. It means trying to uplift my folks, but it's listed as humanities. We learn a lot of things in that class. It teaches about social movements and social injustice.
Why many social movements in America, well, Latin America, Africa as well, focus on education, food programs. Yes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's because even in the face of death, despair, and poverty, a community can respond to those needs and lessen the atmosphere of desperation. Our kids aren't eating before school, so we will start a free breakfast program. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
While we're working on the death, despair, and poverty.
We wouldn't have free breakfast in schools if the Black Panthers didn't start their free breakfast program. You don't learn none of the things that you learn in that one class in all of your classes combined together. No, I mean, nobody is really going to teach you about the Black Panthers. Nobody is going to even in my, none of my history classes have I learned that there were at least 20 major slave revolts that involved 20 or more people in them. It's important to learn about these things because, one, you know, as a black person, you got to know what your people have done. You can't just sit there and think, oh, white man. I mean, you got to know that black people have contributed to this country and they have fought. It's really deep, you know? It's really deep.
That, okay, so we'll cover the rest on Monday. Are you learning anything?
Malton's mom sews a bolt of brightly patterned cloth into an African blouse and skirt she'll wear later to a Nigerian birthday party. For a while, she tolerates her son's hip-hop in the tiny shop.
This is what I reckon with.
But it's Fela Kuti's interpretations of Nigerian parables that she sings along to.
It's the music that everybody knows in Nigeria.
The music reminds her of the home she can't wait to get back to.
I'm not supposed to be here. I have not been to Nigeria. This is the 11th year. I was here in May 29, 1997. My senior brother, His Royal Majesty, the King, Fadeshewa of Shimawa, he has just been crowned. Back there in Nigeria, I've got two grandchildren by my daughter. I have never set my eyes on them. There's so many things I'm missing, but I have no choice. I have to be here until a certain time when I will be able to go to Nigeria.
She hopes that will be soon, once Malton gets past his first 2 years of college. But Malton is not so sure where his home will be. After all these years away, Malton can't even describe where his father's Nigerian kingdom is without consulting a map. And he's no longer sure which side of the world he's supposed to be on.
I'm not planning to live full-time here or there. I mean, here or Nigeria. I kind of want to be back and forth. I've been away for so long, I'm not really sure what to expect, you know? It just makes it that much more special going back, because I haven't been home in such a long time.
For Making Contact, I'm Amy Jeffries in Oakland, California.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. This show has been a special collaboration between National Radio Project and the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Thanks to student producer Amy Jeffries, who wrote and edited this show under the guidance of independent media producer and UC Berkeley J School lecturer Claire Schoen. Special thanks to Edwin Okongo and Lydia Chavez for editing assistance, to Derek Smith, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, and Oakland Technical High School, and to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Con Pham associate director, Andrew Stelzer producer, Puck Lowe associate producer, Elena Bakken-Levy production assistant, and Aubrey Green intern. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.